May it please the court, I'm Bruce Fine, and I'm representing the appellant Carolyn Singh. I'd like 10 minutes opening and 1 minute for rebuttal. The appellant challenges the finding of the district court as clearly erroneous in its conclusion that the appellant had not demonstrated on the record that she suffered from a reading disorder and a mild disorder of processing speed. These are disabilities, a subset of learning disabilities that we alleged and suggest we proved showed she was substantially limited in the learning requirement of multiple choice time-tested performance measures.
Could we go back just a minute? And that is, Ms. Singh is seeking to return to GW?
Yes, Your Honor, with accommodations and, of course, subject to the same academic standards as all other enrollees. The evidence showed that Ms. Singh selected an expert from a roster provided by George Washington University to test her for learning disability. And the expert, Dr. Newman, administered a customary battery of tests. And those tests uniformly showed a very stark discrepancy in her performance on tests that required reading efficiency and tests that did not require reading efficiency. For example, you'll see, Your Honor, on the Nelson-Denny test, although she's got a 95% verbal IQ, she had achieved at the 1% level with regard to a test challenging reading efficiency.
Well, this was one of the diagnostic tests,
yes, Your Honor,
administered by
Dr. Newman.
Now, the judge really didn't heed what Dr. Newman's testimony and gave reasons for that. Wouldn't that cover the testing as well?
The judge, I do not believe, suggested that her testing was invalid in any way. It is true that he made some aversions on her credentials.
Right.
Of course, she was selected from the roster provided by George Washington, not, you know, a subject of forum shopping or anything of that sort. But he did not suggest that the test as it was administered and the results were at all invalid. And indeed, Your Honor,
the evidence of the test came in through Dr. Newman, right?
That is correct. But you'll see if you go to appendix page 411, I'm reading from Dr. Ostrander's report, and he was the star witness for the appellee. And Your Honors, if you look at the paragraph styled element 3, this is page 411. Just tell me when you've got it, and I'll read the, it's an underlined paragraph, element 3. And if you go down, the last sentence in that paragraph states, based upon Dr. Newman's report, there is indeed a notable discrepancy between Ms. Singh's academic functioning in reading fluency and her optimal intellectual capabilities. And there was testimony, Your Honor, that perhaps depression.
That's who's speaking there?
That's Dr. Ostrander. He was the witness for the appellee.
While we're on that subject, what is the WACE, is that the correct pronunciation test? How is it done? Resigned, and Ostrander said that if she gets a 90, she's in the 95th percentile.
Verbal intelligence, yes, Your Honor.
Verbal intelligence, okay. And he says that making adjustments for the fact that it's that the SAT is taken predominantly by the better educated, more intelligent people, her SAT result exactly fits that.
Well, Your Honor, I think
SAT overall.
We understand his testimony. Remember, the verbal IQ she had is 95 percentile. And the testimony showed that her score on verbal and the SAT was 400 and I think 60, which is, of course, very, very low. She had the 600s in the mathematics. And on all of the batteries of tests, Your Honor, that she took that were administered by Dr. Newman that challenged reading efficiency, she performed very, very low. Say on one, the Nelson-Denny test at the 1% level. 1%, very slow but correct in all the answers but one. And another, Woodcock-Johnson, she's at the 9% level in challenging reading efficiency, reading efficiency. And if you then look from the results of Dr. Newman's testing to the appellant's actual performance throughout her academic career, from high school through medical school, you'll find the same discrepancy. When there's demands for reading efficiency to perform well, she is two or three grade levels below what she performs when she is not required to undergo a heavy component of reading and time-tested multiple-choice examination formats. For example, at high school, she's scoring stellar in classroom experience. She takes the New York State Regents exam, Your Honor, Judge Williams. She flunks it in English. The same course she's getting A's in classroom instruction, she has to take a remedial English course. Remedial. This is like Shakespeare descending to Howard Stern. Because she has, remember, this is the appellant skipped two grades. She came in very young graduating. And there isn't any dispute, as the appellees will argue, that she was a gifted student. But when you had these multiple choice formats, she was dismal because it was explained by reading disability and a mild disorder of processing speed that requires her to have more time, which was one of the recommendations of Dr. Newman. Not watering down any of the standards, but needing more time. That's what this disability requires. You're slower in reading and appreciating what your text is telling you. Now, what else in the high school experience corroborates that discrepancy? She took courses in the classroom that she also had the same material tested for AP placement. And in the classroom experience, she's getting 85-92. She didn't get any credit on the AP test because the multiple choice format was there from the outset. The same experience of discrepancy between her performance on multiple choice tests and the non-multiple choice format continues through her college experience and then through medical school. For example, the MedCATS test, that's the corresponding test that medical enrollees take to our LSAT for law school. There are three tests with time-tested multiple choice formats. She's in the 13 to 29, 30% range. The one test where there's not a multiple choice format, she's at 64 to 82. 64 to 82.
Mr. Fine, let me ask you two questions. First of all, we're looking at the district court's finding that assuming disability, she wasn't substantially limited in test-taking abilities, assuming test-taking abilities is a major life. Okay. We've got a lot of assumptions in there. That's clearly erroneous standard, right?
Yes.
Okay. First question I have, what is it specifically, we can't just reweigh the record as if we're trying the case. So you have a heavy burden to show us what in particular, where did the district court
go
clearly err?
Yeah. The district.
And then the second question is, assuming you could convince us on that, what is the, I'm not even sure precisely how this plays out, what is the standard of measure? Is it the average person or is it within the group? The district court went within the limited group, which is favorable to you.
Yes.
Because there's no case law supporting that.
With regard to the latter question,
no,
Your Honor,
the first
question, we think that the record demonstrates there's not a single instance where my client was tested on the same material in a multiple choice and non-multiple choice format where there wasn't a stark discrepancy. And you'll notice in the district court's opinion, he just speculates as to alternate reasons other than having a reading disorder.
Can we go back to weights versus SAT? The SAT certainly is multiple choice, right?
The SAT is multiple
time.
Choice, yes, Your Honor. And that's where
right.
She scored 460 in the verbal.
Ostrander's contention is that it conforms to the results of weights.
Your Honor, we would suggest that contention is not credible. When you have a 460, you took the SAT test like everyone else in this room did. 460 in verbal with an IQ of 95, and she's scoring 600s in the math test? This is clearly a discrepancy. If you got that from your child, you'd ask, what's going wrong here?
The testimony is that there's a range, for her IQ, there's a range of SAT results, and this was within that range.
But the discrepancy, Your Honor, even if you accept that the discrepancy is very marked between that aspect of SAT that required reading efficiency, which is the verbal part, and that which did not, which was the math part. And there you have a discrepancy of 150 or 160 points. That's very strong. And, of course, you can't rely upon just one test in determining whether you've made your case. You're correct, Your Honor. We have to provide more than just one instance of the SAT. But this is chronic. The high school, this college experience, and the medical experience, and Judge Lamberth was unable to point to any single instance where this discrepancy didn't exist.
What?
Excuse me, Your Honor.
Measured as against what group?
Measured at against what her, what you would be expected of a person with a verbal IQ of 95.
Are we going to what the precedent seems to be, which is the general population?
And moving that, Your Honor, that was the amicus is arguing that as a cross appeal. So if we could just wait, I would apologize if you could hold off on that. But what the district court speculated as to what might be an explanation for this persistent discrepancy, as if it wasn't a reading disorder and a mild disorder of processing speed, was, well, maybe she was inattentive, maybe a poor student. But those kinds of characteristics would affect her entire performance. There's no reason to think if you know nothing, you'll perform more poorly on a multiple choice test than on an essay test. If you know nothing, it may be more embarrassing to have an essay rather than multiple choice where you might get the correct answer.
Mr. Fine, are you at this point contending that she is substantially limited in the major life activity of learning, as opposed to the major life, your argument as to the major life activity of test taking of a particular sort?
Well, we had argued, and the district court ruled in our favor on this, that multiple choice test taking was a subset of the major life activity.
I'm asking about the other avenue, that is to say, whether if in fact the standard should be learning, or the activity should be learning, whether you are making any case at this point. I should say that I didn't see you making that case in your briefs.
No, Your Honor, the case was tried on the assumption that this is based upon the trial court's ruling at the summary judgment stage that multiple choice test taking was a subset of learning as a major life activity,
right.
And it was tried on that basis.
Is that consistent with the unanimous opinion in Toyota, where the court looks at the one problem that the plaintiff had, which was with, she had carpal tunnel syndrome, was keeping her arms high up and doing this assembly line work, and said, no, you have to look at a range of motion of tasks.
Well, we think it is, because if you look at the standard of showing disability is between how she performed at given what you would expect with her verbal IQ of 95, this clear discrepancy persisted.
Well,
I don't think then a learning experience is necessarily the same as an employment situation that you're discussing.
Let me move back. It does seem that learning is closely analogous to working in the sense that it's what we do earlier in life before going to school, before going into work. And it is our work when we're young. It requires a variety of tasks, of which multiple choice test taking is one subset, one task, as the judge held. There are others. And the court in Toyota seemed to say, don't focus on that one task that happens to be part of this, or one of the subsets, but look at a whole range of life activities.
Well, I think where this is different is that the district court found that multiple choice taking was the gateway. It was the gateway into all higher education and higher professions, because you can't escape that as being the primary method in medical school and law school and the licensing exams as needed to surmount in order to get into that occupation.
Well,
no one suggests that you can perform on...
If the occupation is narrowly defined, that is to say medical profession, then of course that's true. But what the court said in Toyota was don't look at the specific job, which would be analogous here, but look at the range of jobs. And there are many things one can do without taking multiple choice tests like that.
That is correct, Your Honor. But I think if you go back, first, this is a learning disability case, and this is a case that concerns equal opportunity with the non-disabled to compete with those who are aspiring to being doctors and lawyers. The Americans for Disabilities Act didn't want to limit equal opportunity for the disabled to those who didn't have to aspire to higher education.
Sounds like you are answering Judge Edwards' question after all, and saying it's the medical group, not the general population.
That is what the judge found below, and we would defend. The amici was going to argue that after the cross appeal, and that's why I wanted to desist from going a further explanation.
Can I go back to my earlier question? You said perfectly correctly that the judge ruled in your favor on the proposition of what the life activity in question was to be. Did you create in the record a claim that under the major life activity of learning, you would also win?
No, we did not.
You did not.
We did not try the case and present evidence on that theme after the summary judgment ruling, Your Honor. And I don't think we could expect it after we prevailed. We didn't have a trial on an issue that the judge already had decided in our favor.
No, but in presenting the summary judgment,
yeah,
was your argument in the alternative, it's learning and or test taking? In other words, did you preserve that theory and the trial judge just took a subset of it, or what? You never went for learning, only test taking.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. But I'd like to have time during the opposition's argument to make certain that's an accurate answer.
Thank you. You've used your time, but we'll give you a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yes, good morning, Your Honors. There's a little bit of housekeeping first. We came in as amici on the cross appeal, as a cross appellee. So if it agrees with Your Honor, I'd like to reserve the majority of my time so that they may make the argument rather than me posit their argument for them. But
we're pretty familiar with their argument.
Right. But what the amici says is, and you're right, Judge Edwards, it seems as if the previous precedent may suggest that the comparison group is the public at large or the average person or...
Has anyone gone the other way? DOC, DOJ, and all the case law seems to be to the contrary of what you're arguing.
Well, actually, we say the ADA itself does not permit that type of comparison.
All right,
because
so you're saying the case law and the authorities are wrong, and you're going to tell us why?
Well,
what I'm asking you, is there any authority that supports your view?
Well, we believe parts of Sutton can be read to support our view, because what happens is, I think there's a couple of nuanced points at which we have to look at the argument. First of all, we're saying that a person is impaired, and we believe that that is where this first cut should be made. It should be made by the professionals doing the testing and making the decision if a person has an impairment. And that would be according to professional standards, normed according to the community at large or most people, however the professionals norm the tests. Now it's determined according to expert testimony that a particular individual is impaired. Now, are they substantially limited? We say the ADA requires the next step of the analysis to be individually tailored. And if you were to say that, and here's where some of the imprecision in language comes forth, most people, average people, the difference in those two terms are quantitative and qualitative. Average person suggests that you do some type of norming for the average person, correct? And we say that that immediately precludes individuals from attending postgraduate schools of any type. Because by their very definition, individuals attending a postgraduate education are above average. They've exceeded the average. Even one would suggest undergraduate may exceed the average individual if you're looking at a cohort of the United States or English-speaking
people. I guess I'm not sure that if it were the case that under the average person standard, someone could not be learning disabled, that's say substantially limited the major life activity of learning, that such person would not get help from the statute, I'm not sure that that is a particularly strong case that the statute doesn't mean that.
Well, if they come forward, if I understand your question, Judge Williams, if they come forward and they say they are diagnosed with an impairment, now we have to say, does that substantially limit their ability to learn, say medical school or law school or dental school or graduate school? Now they have to show what is the level playing field that the ADA wants them to play on, correct?
Yeah, the level playing field metaphor here is so often, I think, is kind of deceptive, because I think you're doing sort of a mixing and matching. Mr. Fine pointed out the discrepancy of 150 or more points between the math and the verbal. I don't think that's so terribly uncommon, and if everyone who has such a gap is therefore, assuming an impairment, is learning disabled for purposes of the statute, I think you're going to have a large increment in number of learning disabled people. And of course, the principle would have to be applied beyond the area of learning.
No, but perhaps I've made not made my argument articulately, but what we're saying is the impairment has to be established before you do the substantially limited, right? And that is the impairment, that level is cutting out your concerns, I would suggest, Judge Williams, because what it's saying is you have been expertly diagnosed with an impairment. Therefore, people who have weaker skill sets in, a lot of lawyers are not great in math. That doesn't mean they're impaired math-wise, correct?
Let's take one who is impaired. I mean, I don't think you're saying, or are you, that every impairment is a disability?
No, absolutely not. That's the next test, and that's what we're saying, is that now you have an impairment. People can be impaired. I've heard of individuals who find out years later that they are slightly colorblind or that they have some other impairment that they went through their entire life without being aware of.
The fellow who realized he'd been speaking prose all along.
So what ends up happening is now we have to find out, are you substantially limited? And it has to be a major life activity, be it learning, be it working, depending on how you consider these professional schools,
now
right?
You're saying that if we use the general population test, then no person who is impaired would ever be able to meet it in professional schools?
That's correct.
What about a blind person in law school?
I'm sorry, you're right, Judge Edwards, and we limited in the amici to processing disorders, the type of processing disorders we're talking about.
All right, so then your overstatement is clearly excessive. It's not right that if we use the general population test, we've killed all handicapped or disabled persons in professional schools. That's not accurate.
That's correct. You're right, Judge Edwards.
And why is that not the case?
Because a blind person would clearly satisfy the general population.
That's correct.
Norm. A paralyzed person in law school would clearly satisfy the general norm. I think there are any of a number of categories.
Yes, we know that to be, we think that to be true.
Right.
But the question is why? What's the principle?
Yeah.
Well, why is it true that the blind person would be regarded as disabled and entitled to accommodation under the Act, but somebody else who's impaired would not be?
Well, that's exactly, I guess, our point, Your Honor, is that we're saying that the blind person isn't they're not being forced to meet a higher standard to make the level playing field like you would be at a professional education. In other words,
it seems to me that's
I'm not following
that's that. The conclusion. I'm still asking what the reason, the question, why. Why is it that the blind person is not expected to go through without help, and somebody else who's impaired is impaired?
You don't think
but
a blind person
disabled.
Can ask for accommodation under the statute?
No. Yes. Yes. No. We're absolutely assuming that. But he's trying to say, how are we distinguishing that?
Some people are impaired, but they're not disabled. Right. And I'm trying to figure out how do we discern the difference.
Well, what we would say is, obviously, the ADA anticipates that This type of processing disorder is a disability, okay? So that this, a learning disorder, a processing disorder, it's specifically enumerated, these types of disorders are disabilities.
Well,
so then,
I think what all we know is that learning is included, and so some learning problems are covered by the Act. But that's about all we know from the statute,
right?
Even the regs.
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
So I'm still asking, how do we know which ones are covered and which are not? Which impairments are disabilities?
Well, your contention, as I understand it, is that anything that's been classified as an impairment and produces, I guess, significant discrepancies in test taking qualifies, right?
Right. As and like I said, if they're normed and expertly, you know, identified.
Only against the limited group, not against the general population.
Look, I think
you're not going to have substantial impairment if you go against the general population.
Okay.
Right?
I'm sorry?
490 is not so bad as against the general population.
That's correct.
Okay.
No, but what I'm saying is that's different than the impairment. In other words, you have to be impaired first.
Right.
Okay. And so we agree that they're diagnosed, they have expert
testimony. District Court assumed that, right?
That's correct.
Okay. So it's substantially limited. And how do you measure it?
Right.
Is what I'm trying to understand.
And we're saying that if you say that it has to be the average person, which
right.
we say the ADA does not say, there's no comparison like that.
No, I understand.
Then you're immediately saying that anybody who wants to do anything above average, i.e., go to, you know,
not
undergrad.
Not anyone, only persons with certain of the impairments.
That's correct.
We've
this type of this type of disability is precluded from a level playing field in postgraduate education. They because by its very nature.
That's not an implausible interpretation of the Act, is it? I mean, The Act is addressing this situation that affects millions of people, 43 million people, right? And who have trouble in their daily lives, and that it doesn't provide relief for people at such an elite level is not implausible.
Well, we would say that this is exactly the type of situation in learning and processing disorders.
See, I don't
that the ADA.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's all right.
No, answer the chief.
That the ADA is addressing and meant to address. And you can't say, we would suggest that of a remedialist statute, to say that it draws the line, if you want to be, if you want to have some type of profession where you have no, you know, you need to take civil service exams to do even manual labor jobs. If you're going to say that people who have processing disorders have to be compared with anybody who doesn't want to have above average education or above
why
average.
Why isn't a blind person's disability characterized as a processing disorder?
That's beyond my
no, but
expertise.
I mean, it is a processing disorder, right?
I think it can be distinguished a processing or psychological disability versus a physical disability, Your Honor.
But we know the statute covers more than physical.
Right,
disability.
Exactly. I see my time is.
See, one of the interesting questions here is, and especially in the professional context, and I don't know how to think about it, and I think it's just really hard. Somewhere in here, especially with this processing disorder characterization, there's a question as to whether or not there's a legitimate concern that certain people with certain processing disorders may not be able to cut it in the profession in which we're looking at. And
but
that the screening is going, and that's where the blind person as opposed to this kind of processing disorder is easily distinguishable in my mind. In other words, there are certain processing disorders that you know may impair the person in performing the work.
Right.
And so they get screened out, and so you say to yourself, well, so what? We want them screened out, not this individual.
It may be that they get screened out only because the accommodation required.
Right.
Right. That's the rest of the third part of the analysis is the accommodation. Otherwise, we're into the, you know, the infinite monkey theorem. I mean, after a while, could a number of monkeys, you know, type everything that's in the British Museum? Yes, you know, given enough time, but at this level, that's the next analysis. Can there be a reasonable accommodation? And we're, of course, expecting that anybody, even who demonstrates an impairment and demonstrates that they're substantially limited, must still have a reasonable accommodation and must also satisfy the academic criterion. We would not say you cannot, you know, you have to water down your standards. Absolutely not, because that would defeat the whole purpose of the level playing field.
How far do you carry the specialization? There seem to be an extraordinarily small number of slots for PhD candidates in economics in the country. Is someone who has impairment issue, who simply is, as a result of it, significantly slower at math than the other people applying who have some chance of getting in, is that person disabled within the meaning of the Act?
Well, I think that there's two parts to that answer. Number one is that we think the district court got it right and that it's individuals, and we say that this is mentioned in Sutton too, the comparison group is individuals of similar age and education. So if you're talking about PhD candidates, you would not just be talking about PhD candidates.
No, so it's backward looking.
It's backward.
It's not tuned to
where you're
what
going.
The person is aspiring to. It's tuned to where he or she has arrived.
Well, where they are, yes. And who are your cohorts? Who is a similar age and educational background? Because that is the appropriate cohort.
Well, maybe in the economics hypothetical, the answer would be you'd never get into school if there was a great disparity in your math versus your verbal. If you had no math numbers, no good PhD program is going to bring you in.
Well, Princeton now has a non-quantitative economics precisely because
they've always been suspect.
All right, okay. I think we've
okay.
We'll give you a moment for it.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. There's one question that lies at the heart of this case, and it's just one, and that's whether substantial evidence supports the district court's conclusion that Ms. Singh failed to prove that she has a disability for the purposes of the ADA. The answer to that question is an unequivocal yes. There is substantial evidence supporting the district court's conclusion. For that reason, the court should affirm the judgment in GW's favor. Now, we also submit, Your Honor,
you know, when you speak of substantial evidence, which actually linguistically is not exactly the formula, but are you suggesting that we look only at the evidence favoring that proposition, or do we look at all the evidence?
Your Honor, the test focuses on whether there is substantial evidence supporting the district court's conclusion.
It's a matter of saying we don't look at the contrary.
Well, if it's a matter of weighing the evidence, if there's evidence on one side and evidence on the other, and the district court rationally chooses one or the other.
Okay, so we have to look at the comparative weight.
Well, Your Honor, I would say that it's not this court's charge to re-weigh the evidence. This court isn't another juror.
So no, but we can look to see whether the district court failed to consider the other side.
Or unreasonably weighed.
In other words, it isn't simply a question as to whether or not what is cited, if looked at alone, is enough. It's whether what is cited in light of what was not cited or excluded or ignored or weighed incorrectly produced a result that survives or doesn't survive clearly erroneous review. If the district court fails to consider relevant factors, that would clearly weigh very heavily on the other side and gives no explanation as to how you can be rid of them. You've got a problem.
If that happened, Your Honor, I think that could be a problem. Fortunately, it did not happen here. Your Honor, in our position is substantial evidence does not require, does not mandate, does not authorize re-weighing. It asks this
court. It's not re-weighing de novo, but it certainly requires us to ask whether it was a completely unreasonable weighing below. I'm surprised to hear you making the argument you appear to be making.
Well, I'm not saying you disregard any evidence on the other side, but the question, Your Honor, is whether there is evidence, substantial evidence, looking at the record, considered as a whole, to support the district court's conclusion. And our position, sir, on the facts, is that there is substantial evidence to support the district court's conclusion.
Are you assuming the substantial evidence test and the clearly erroneous test are coterminous?
A court's finding below is clearly erroneous if there is not substantial evidence to support it. That's our position, Your Honor.
You can have a clearly erroneous finding without regard to whether there's substantial evidence. It depends upon what the court did and did not consider. I mean, that's what I thought the standard that we were facing here was clearly erroneous.
That is our submission, Your Honor. That is what we're saying. But we're also saying that there is a court's opinion, the district court's decision, is not clearly erroneous if there is substantial evidence supporting it. That is our point of view.
Okay.
So on to the question of the two central questions here, whether there's substantial evidence to support the district court's finding that there is no impairment, and is there substantial evidence to support the district court's conclusion that even if there is an impairment, it's not substantially limiting. As to the impairment, Ms. Singh pointed only to two possible impairments, a mild processing speed disorder and dyslexia. And substantial evidence supports the district court's conclusion that there was no mild processing speed disorder. What's the evidence in support? Dr. Ann Ostrander, whose testimony the district court credited, couldn't have been more clear. He said that learning disabilities of the type that Ms. Singh is alleging are lifelong disabilities. You expect them to manifest themselves early in a student's academic, in a person's academic career, and manifest themselves throughout the academic career. The evidence in this case points exactly the other way. She has been very successful academically from a very early age. You'll recall that she learned to read at the age of 3. She tested into an elite academic institution while she was in Indiana, her place of birth. Once here in the United States, she tested 2 grades above her normal grade and was able to place into the 10th grade at an academically elite school in New York, one of the best schools in New York, and in a gifted and talented program in that school. She graduated near the top of her class with a very strong grade point average. She passed all of her regents with scores ranging into the 90s. She performed well on the SATs, at or above average, depending upon whose description you accept. And she accomplished all of those things without any accommodation and while pursuing a very active academic and extracurricular life. All of those facts, Your Honor, points away from the conclusion that she has a processing speed disorder. In other words, it supports.
Why was she admitted to the decelerated program?
The record is not entirely clear on that, Your Honor. There was no testimony, there was no evidence on why Ms. Singh was admitted into the decelerated program. We know that people are admitted into the decelerated program sometimes when there is something out of line between the student's academic performance or a student's performance on the MCAT, or when the student might have relatively weak science grades. Those are reasons that oftentimes will prompt GW to admit someone.
It sounds like the plaintiff's theory here, that there was a discrepancy between the MCATs and the academic performance. And
so I believe that is their. I believe that is their theory, but where their theory falls short is that the discrepancy does not constitute a substantial limitation in the major life activity of taking time multiple choice tests. That's assuming, Your Honor, that taking time multiple choice tests is a major life activity, which is something we do not accept. So in any event, she performed well academically through college, which points away from the conclusion that she has a processing speed disorder. She did all of those things without accommodations. And again, The conclusion, I believe, is well supported in the record that she has no processing speed disorder. The same is true for dyslexia. Dyslexia is a reading disorder that you would expect to manifest itself early in a person's academic career and throughout their academic career. She learned to read by the age of 3. She's a terrific speller, which is inconsistent with having dyslexia. And she excelled through college. So again, there's more than ample evidence. There's more than ample evidence in this record that supports the district court's conclusion that she doesn't have dyslexia.
Can you tell me where the district court precisely said she did not suffer an impairment as distinguished from she did not suffer an impairment that substantially limited her in test taking? I didn't remember the district court. I remember reading that several times. It looked like he was fudging it. I don't remember him saying this is not an impairment. I remember him saying, in effect, what he seemed to be saying, in effect, was whatever this impairment is, it doesn't substantially limit the major life activity of test taking.
I believe what the district court actually said was that she failed to prove that she has an impairment which substantially limits her major life activity of test taking.
Well, that's not the same as saying she doesn't have an impairment.
I think subsumed within that is the conclusion that she didn't prove that she has an impairment.
Well, here's what the district court said in July. The court already held, referring back to March, the summary judgment, the court already held the plaintiff had an impairment of some sort,
right,
whether it be a learning disability, as she contends, or a depression, as defendant believes. Impairment of some sort. So the only question left would be, I suppose, whether it's
substantially limited.
Substantially limited.
That's what I thought.
Or whether she presented with the...
It's not entirely clear how the district court conceptualized this, because immediately after saying what I just quoted, the court goes on to look at impairment and says, based on the evidence presented at trial, which of course is different than the summary judgment record, this court does not find the plaintiff has a disability as defined by the ADA in the case law. So it's as if saying, she has an impairment. This is consistent, I think, mm-hmm. with Ms. LaFon's conception. Yes, she has an impairment, but it's not a disability as a matter of law, which could be because it doesn't substantially limit, or perhaps for some other reason.
Well, to move this to the substantially limited question, Ms. Singh, at the appellate level, appends her substantial limitation on just one purported major life activity, and that's taking time multiple choice tests. Now again, GW does not agree that taking time multiple choice tests is a major life activity, but assume for the moment that it is. The evidence shows that Ms. Singh performed well on such tests, at least until she entered or applied for medical school. She took the New York State Regents, again, scoring, which are time multiple choice tests, scoring well into the 90s.
But she flunked the English.
Well, that's what she says, Your Honor. But if you look at her transcript, and I'm afraid I can't quote you the exact page in the joint appendix where the transcript appears, there's no evidence. There is a listing of the New York State Regents exams. There's no reflection there that she failed a New York State Regents exam at all. None. So that is what she says. But
well,
again,
I would certainly ask counsel. I mean, that's it's got to be one way or the other. I mean, you're asserting that she had stellar English grades on the Regents, and the other side is saying she flunked English and had to do it again. I mean, we ought to get that one cleared up. It may be that there's nothing at all in the record, then you can't assert anything either.
Well, what I can't assert, Your Honor, is what the school record reflects. What the school record reflects is that she didn't, there's no indication in the school record, sir, that she flunked anything. Or at least certainly no New York State Regents exam.
No, the question is whether there's anything in the record before us to support what the other side says, that she flunked the English.
There is her testimony, sir. There is her testimony. She did testify. My recollection is that she did testify that she had to take a remedial course. I don't recall whether she testified.
Well, that's part of the record before us. Then why would you assert that it's not there? If she testified and it's in the trial record, then it's, and you didn't attempt to refute it, then she flunked the exam. I'm not getting it. If she testified she flunked the Regents, You didn't refute it, and it's in the trial record, then the record is case confirms what they're suggesting is she flunked the English exam.
Well, I will say this, Your Honor, also. Judge Lamberth commented on her recollection of her performance on other examinations, but it was vague and anecdotal. He seemed to discredit her recollection.
Where did he say, because this becomes important, now I'm really confused, where did he say she's claimed that all of her past performance in this particular area has been weak, but in support of that, she cited the Regents exam, which she flunked. I discredit that. Where did
no,
he say that?
He did not take that on head on by specifically mentioning.
So the question we're trying to understand is, there is a record, contrary to what you're suggesting, that at every stage, if she flunked that Regents exam, then at every stage she's done poorly in the area which she now claims. She always does poorly. She flunked the Regents exam. She did poorly, relatively speaking, in the SAT and in all the other, in the diagnostic tests. She's always done poorly in these areas. Where do you think she's done well? What in the record indicates that she has done well in her past history?
She has done well.
Not overall, in this area. In the English, in the multiple choice areas.
On the SAT, Your Honor,
she's got a 400-something.
Actually, she scored either 500 or 510. I don't recall the exact number, which was her strongest score. She had a weaker score in the 400s, but her strongest score was in the 500 range.
Are you pointing to the lower left-hand column on page 329 of the Joint Appendix? It's French R-E-G-R, then Ing, Regent R.
Did you say 329, sir?
329, yeah. The lower left-hand corner when you rotate the Joint Appendix.
Yes, sir.
Okay. And so is her contention about having to take something remedial, is that before she produced these scores, or is it unknown, or what?
Sir, my understanding is that Defense Exhibit Number 21, which appears on page 329 of the Joint Appendix, is Ms. Singh's final high school transcript. And in the lower left-hand corner of that document, it recites each of her Regents exam scores. And as I stated earlier, there's nothing in that, on that document, which I believe reflects all of her Regents exam scores, that indicates that she failed any Regents exam.
And then the next to it, the column SAT 10/95, 500 verbal, 610 math.
That's correct, Your Honor.
How's that compared to your class?
At GW?
Yeah.
I do not know. I do not know how that compares to the class. I do know, however,
I thought medical school was reserved for angels, people who got 800s on their math and close to that on their verbal.
So there's nothing in the record that reflects what the average SAT score going into GW Medical School is. But we would submit, Your Honor, that that is not a relevant inquiry with respect to what the ADA is pointing us to, that the ADA points to, the ADA asks us to consider how this individual, how any individual is, how that impairment that they're alleging affects their ability to perform a major life activity when compared to the average person in the general population. And I would submit, certainly, Your Honor, that GW is full of angels at the medical school and throughout the university, but whether that score that Ms. Singh obtained is high or low in comparison to what the average score GW is not a relevant consideration, we would submit, Your Honor, because the question is how she performed relative to the average person in the general population. I see that my...
You did take on at the very last page of your brief the point that taking timed multiple choice tests is not a major life activity.
Yes, sir.
If that's correct, then I take it that taking such tests would be completely outside of any remediation under the ADA, any relief under the ADA, right? So all of these practices of extending the time allowed for certain people who have a visual impairment or a processing speed disorder would be without warrant in the act.
No, I wouldn't go that far, Your Honor. If a person is unable to see, going back to the example that Judge Edwards posited, if a person is unable to see, and the person certainly would be entitled to an accommodation on on a multiple choice, a time multiple choice test. If a person is on a...
But that's not because taking tests is a major life activity.
Correct. If their only limitation is manifested in an inability to take time multiple choice tests, if that's the extent of their limitation, our position is that they haven't manifested a limitation with respect to a major life activity, because taking time multiple choice tests is not the sort of organic day-to-day function that virtually everyone does every day.
Is reading?
Yes.
Reading is?
Reading, I would submit, is a major life activity. Although that's not...
It's not covered by any of the regs.
Pardon me?
It's not covered by any of the regs.
But most people would do it every day, I would say. That's something that you would expect the average person to be able to do at some level every day. Taking time multiple choice tests is an activity reserved for a relatively narrow portion of our population.
Well,
certainly
those
taking,
that want to go to college.
Those who want to go to college, or in this case, who also want to go to medical school.
Well, but it starts with those who want to go to college, right?
That is true.
Probably 40% of the cohort.
I apologize, I couldn't hear you, Your Honor.
Probably about 40% of the cohort.
I wouldn't be able to address that. I don't know the precise or even the approximate percentage. I see that my time is at an end. Let me just conclude by saying that we believe that Ms. Singh has fundamentally misconstrued, misapplied what this court is supposed to be doing. The court is not here to reweigh the evidence. That's not the provenance of this court. The court is here to determine whether the decision of the court below was clearly erroneous. The district court's prerogative was to weigh the evidence. It did so carefully. It did so thoughtfully. And under the clearly erroneous standard, this court must uphold those findings, those factual findings of the district court, so long as substantial evidence supports them. We say the record brims with evidence supporting the district court. Therefore, the court should affirm the judgment in the district court's favor. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Fine.
Did you get an answer to the question?
Thank you,
Your
Honor. If I could start out with Judge Edwards' question. I think, again, if you look on that same reference to the Appendix 329 that you also referenced, Judge Williams, you'll see in the middle box there a course that was the remedial reading course. I think she got 95 on that. She got a half a credit. That's indicated on grade 10. This would be the first horizontal column. You see it says AD, WR, and LT.
I'm sorry.
That's the remedial course. It would be, if you look at grade 10 at the top of that chart, at the one, two,
ceramics, right,
it starts with ceramics, and then you'll see the CR, AD, WR, and LT. That's the remedial reading course that she took and received 95. She got a half credit. But that just goes to bolster what Judge Edwards already understood is the uncontradicted testimony in the record that she did fail the test. There's no...
Is there some citation to the uncontradicted evidence in the record? I'm asking whether that's the case. Where is it in the record?
I mean, other than the testimony of Carolyn Singh?
Do you have that citation?
I do not have it right now, but we'll provide it afterwards if you'd like, Your Honor.
Mr. Fine, I'm still at a loss to find this in grade 10. Can you help me again?
It's about eight down.
Yeah. It says CR credit, and then it says AD, WR, and LT.
Okay, that's it. Okay, thank you. Start the minute over, please, Mr. Fine.
Is it in the record? Oh, well, first, do you want to answer the other question that Judge Edwards and I were asking about the state of the claims on learning, if learning is the major life activity?
Well, what we, and Your Honor, one of the elements of disability here, reading disability, is one that affects not just the multiple choice testing experience, but the process of reading as part of classroom work. And one of the accommodations that was recommended was to have a device, it's a computer software, that would enable a student to take written material, upload it into the software, and so they would hear the words from the laptop as well as reading it, because there is not a disability with the appellant with regard to processing information that is read, that comes through the ears rather than through the eyes. But that, I think, demonstrates, Your Honor, that this impairment is not just an impairment that affects the multiple choice testing, but any time you've got reading intensive requirements that requires efficient processing of information, efficient reading. That's why this impairment is more than affecting just the multiple choice experience.
Thank you.
Okay, and then I take it you're saying that you're having advanced that below, kept impairment of learning as a major life activity in the case.
Well, certainly, Your Honor, insofar as a reading impairment, reading is a requirement in virtually every non-math course. And so, insofar as the demonstration which we submitted was shown by Dr. Newman's testing, showed that dyslexia, the reading impairment, made it obligatory to spend more time or have an assistance like an optical scanner that could, software that would enable you to hear what you're reading as well as to visually see it, affected more than just multiple choice test taking. Now, you also raised, Judge Williams, the issue of whether or not there would be a legitimate reason to try to screen out persons with disabilities in because they may be less able after they've graduated to perform in their profession. But George Washington does have persons at present with similar disabilities of my client who are receiving accommodations. George Washington certainly thinks these people are competent enough to perform in the profession after they graduate. And Judge Ginsburg and I believe Judge Edwards were also raising the issue of how to interpret the ADA in light of its purpose and whether or not it could rationally be applied in a way that would screen out or may have a ceiling on people who are aspiring to more than the average kind of work or profession or achievement because the act was calculated, so to speak, to help those who were maybe limited in finding any work at all. But I think the record is rather clear in the legislative history and in the findings of Congress that the ADA was to be modeled after the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The Civil Rights Act was held as the gold standards of equal opportunity. And surely it would be, I think, foolish to suggest that equal opportunity standard in the Civil Rights Act would prevent minorities based upon race from competing equally for jobs as lawyers, as accountants, as attending medical or professional schools, or even being judges. That equal opportunity standard was across the board.
Apples and oranges.
I don't think so, Your Honor,
because there's characteristically, at least, no doubt that the plaintiff fits into a particular group, right? Here, the opening question is whether the plaintiff fits into the protected group, period.
Well, of course, we have to satisfy that standard, but in terms of providing the comparison, Your Honor, it's that the individual has to prove they had otherwise qualified. There is no one is suggesting that someone who shows an impairment, a disability, automatically gets a free ride.
No,
she still has to make competence as anyone else.
I just am questioning your use of the analogy to the Civil Rights Act.
Only to the extent, Your Honor, I agree that your distinction is a valid one, but we're just suggesting the analogy to the Civil Rights Act of 64 is there to show that the purpose of Congress was to create equal opportunity wherever you were in a particular walk of life and aspiration or ambition. It wasn't intended to screen out one part of public life and say, here we don't want equal opportunity to apply.
Any further questions?
I do have a question. This fascinating list in the corner of page 329, French part of the Regents' exam require less verbal processing than the English?
I'm unable to. I don't know
and
the answer
you know
to that
what?
Question.
USH Gov and SEC, MIII, and the other SECs are.
No, I don't believe there was any testimony on that, Your Honor. But I would just make this general observation, Judge Williams. We certainly understand that you've got to show a pattern, that it would be wrong to just single out one particular test as showing either there was absolute proof or not. This has got to be something that's persistent. And what we think is so telling in this particular case is that this discrepancy has remained chronic from high school through the medical school. For example, right up into the medical school, one of her courses on psychiatry, on the non-multiple choice format, she got 94. the same material in the multiple choice 71. But that's just, and it's not just an aberration here. I think you've got to look globally. What does the entire record show? And I think Judge Edwards got it right when he observed the district court wasn't to find any instance, not a single one, where there is a parity in how the appellant performed on a non-multiple choice test as opposed to a multiple choice comparative. And he was straining to find other explanations for this persistent discrepancy. Well, she was inattentive. She didn't concentrate. She squandered her time. All explanations that would have made her performance poor across the board.
Would your client know the answer to the questions I had about items there?
I can inquire.
Do so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. I can take a moment.
To the best of my client's recollection, the French exam, she was uncertain whether she was read or listened to French words and tried to give meanings or otherwise. She is uncertain, Judge Williams, as to what the intensity of reading was as opposed to another format. Now,
What about these mysterious things? Yeah. Sec.
Yeah, that's
three different.
Sec. That those are math. That's I don't. Those are math tests,
okay.
Sec 1, 2, 3.
And the U.S.
That's U.S. government. She said that was an essay test. Then the last one is biology, which is biology. And then global, whatever it is. I think that's a social studies kind of test. And that was multiple choice. That's where she got 77.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fine.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Morris. Thank you. Case is submitted.